Hey, it's Jake, and welcome to the Settlers Podcast. This week on the show, we have Rod Abernathy. Now, Rod is a Renaissance man in every sense of the term. He is a professor of music, a composer, an artist. He's won a BAFTA for his work he's done composing for video games. He's a very well-rounded guy and a delight to talk to. So, without any further ado, this is Rod Abernathy. Well, cool. So, I saw you had a North Carolina phone number. Where are you based out of?
I'm in the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill area.
Oh, okay. I didn't spend any time in Raleigh, but I was living in Brevard, North Carolina, right outside of Asheville for several months. And
yeah, it's beautiful up there.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah, I was born and raised near Brevard in Rutherford County.
Okay, that sounds familiar. Yeah. I didn't stray too much. I was going from Columbia, South Carolina to Brevard, North Carolina, and staying at each for a couple weeks or months at a time.
You probably got up to Asheville, didn't you?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I love Asheville. Asheville's great.
North Carolina, that part of the country is definitely a place I could see myself living, full time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I was lucky to have been raised there. I just have North Carolina is crazy, man. It takes, 8 or 9 hours to drive from one end to the other, and you can go from incredible mountains to, the beach.
Outer Banks, right?
Yeah. It's nuts, but I love it here.
Yeah, well, and particularly like Asheville and Raleigh, the music scene is pretty incredible. Obviously, you're a big part of that.
It's always been a hotbed of music, different kinds of music too. What can I say? Moonshine does a lot for people.
Yeah. For certain, a great history of bootleggers there. So are you also a professor? Was I reading that in your bio that you teach?
That sounds pretty formal, and we all get weird images of professors when you say that name.
But a lot of tweed, I'm imagining.
I'm an adjunct professor. I do teach one semester on how to create music for video games at University of North Carolina School of the Arts. And they asked me to do this about 4 years ago because of my experience in composing for video games.
Right. But how do you like teaching? Is that,
I love it. Yeah, it really is incredible. I never thought I would be teaching anyone in a classroom. It's kind of an odd setting, but it's not unlike being on stage in a very small way. It's kind of like doing a house concert, sort of. It's a little bit more casual, but the students, and I hate to call them students because we also think students, we have an image when we say students. And these are composers I'm working with. They already have a 4-year degree in music. So I'm sort of with my peers in a way. They're just starting out earlier than I'm at right now.
That is a very cool way to look at it.
Yeah. They're from all over the world. My classes, I guess I have normally about 8 people in the class.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah. So it's not like I'm in a big room with 100 people. It's not that. It's more one-on-one many times. And School of the Arts is sort of a, not private school, but it's a smaller kind of setting. They really concentrate on the arts. So the people that go there, they're concentrated, they're focused, they're ready to learn whatever it is.
Well, and plus you're in such an intimate environment too. That's like ideal.
Yeah.
Having 8 to 10 students and being able to really just, I feel like that's such a great way to communicate. And if, like you were saying, these are people who already have such a strong base, and then now just kind of get a little direction from somebody like you has a lot of experience with it. I mean,
well, I appreciate that. I learn a lot by teaching these people. I just do. And it makes me, in retrospect, go back and learn what I thought I knew.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I know. Go ahead, Rod.
Well, it's also a different facet of my whole musical experience because it has nothing to do with what I'm doing at the moment with playing live and doing this folk Americana part of my life, which I've been trying to get back to for many, many years.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the whole, you know, kind of deconstruction of everything, I think, is a really crucial part for growth. I remember something you just said reminded me of some of the best advice I have ever gotten. And it was in the context of training in judo. And I was, you know, training and then also trying to start coaching as well. And the coach had told me, if you can teach it, you own it. And I thought that was such a cool way to think about it because, you know, you learn all these things and whatever the medium is, you know, for me, it was like learning techniques and stuff like that, you know, to try to apply in matches. But it was almost like if I couldn't break it down and teach it to somebody else, I was kind of just borrowing it. It was like on loan. But if it was something that I really understood and I could express and show to somebody else, you know, that became mine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. And, you know, we're all borrowing our stuff in one way or the other anyway.
Certainly. Certainly. Nothing new under the sun.
No, not really. But teaching really opened up my, I don't know how to put it. The perspective of my whole composing career. It just kind of went, okay, now I got to tell somebody how I got into it and why I got into it and what I did. And it took me weeks to get together my, what they call a syllabus.
Right.
It's you just don't walk into the classroom and go, hey, love, where's my coffee? you know, these people expect to be, you know, to hear stuff worth their time. So
right, and to be kind of challenged by, you know, different perspective, I would imagine.
Yeah,
I had some questions you know, about composing a video game. So I'm not a gamer. I love video games, and it's absolutely the reason I don't play them, because I am an addict in every sense. I feel the moment I put a controller in my hand, I feel that creeping in. Like this is, I'm gonna give my life to this.
I hear you.
So that's why I don't play, but I respect them immensely. And I've talked to, you know, on this podcast, I've had several musicians who also composed for film, but never somebody who had composed for video games. So I was curious about what. You know, what is different for you, Rod, when you are looking at composing a film or composing a video game?
That's a loaded question.
Sure, I imagine.
Of course, it depends on the film or the video game because there's no one way to do it. I think most people, no matter what kind of creative thing you're doing, you have a starting point where you sit down and go, okay, here's my starting point. Here's my reference. Film is a linear medium. Like if you're scoring to a film, you have the edit and you're scoring to the action that you see and you never go backwards. You're going forward with your music. You never have to worry about, oh, okay, I better go back to that. And that might be revisited because in a video game, you can go backwards, forwards. Usually there's all kinds of things that are determined by the gamer. So the gamer has control of going into a room or going into a battle or visiting a landscape. In a movie, the director and editor make that call. So video games, your music usually has to be flexible enough to not be repetitive. You don't want to go back to that same track again in the same way. And then that depends on the budget that people have for their music scores. The more budget you have, the more flexibility you have in the music. It gets kind of complicated. And then also the engine in the video game, technically the audio engine that they're using, how that can take your music tracks and allow you to, like a puzzle, put things together so it doesn't play the same way twice.
Mm.
Also, video game music is usually written in layers, whereas in a movie, you hand your mix to the editor or the director. Here's your mix. You know, like you do, like you're sending a CD, you're making an album, and you mix it. And there it is. It's done. You don't ever go back to it. And in video games, sometimes you hand what they call stems, like separate horns, strings, drums, guitar, whatever, percussion. Those are all on separate tracks. You hand that to the audio director, and he's going to put it into an audio engine that will predetermine what's being played. Is that complicated enough for you?
That is super complicated.
Yeah, and that is just, you're just scratching the surface on the way a lot of different games can be done.
Right, because I mean, I'm just thinking about from my limited game playing experience how, you know, sometimes you're hearing one thing, you know, like the overarching musical theme, and then you stray to the right and the music starts to get more intense, like, oh shit, I might be stumbling upon something, or you get damaged and then the music is getting progressively more intense.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just seems like there are
A
million different things to take into account.
Well, it can be. It depends on the level I hate to put it so basically, but it depends on the budget that you've got to work with.
Sure.
If the game, if the people in the game come and say, we just want some music underneath gameplay, and here's level one, and write us a track. Then you write a track like you would any track, and it loops, like a 60-second or 2-minute loop. It just loops under gameplay. And a lot of times that can get real repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, if they are more into the music, I'm talking about the developer, you'll have a track, let's say, you start with this big bombastic action track, and you hear it all the time in movies and whatever. It's like, you know, you've got strings and horns and might have an electric guitar and whatever. But then you can strip that down to the very basic level, which is not so loud. And that can play underneath before battle. And then as battle comes, or, you know, as it gets more and more intense, you add parts over that. It's almost like you're mixing in the studio, but you're mixing that in the video game audio engine. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That is wild. I don't think, you know, like many things, I don't think the level of complexity is appreciated. I feel like we hear stuff like that at such a low resolution, or think about it at such a low resolution, and really what goes into composing a video game. That's why I asked, because I figured there must be so much different about composing for a video game than to a film.
It can be, but you got to remember that composing for anything, you have to have structure and you need some kind of melodic content and harmonic content. So it's not, you kind of start in the same place. Like, they'll say, we need a theme for, you know, I'll just use Lord of the Rings, for instance, or
I'm glad Hobbit. You did. Yes, yeah. I'm glad you did. I have many questions.
Yeah, let's say like something like The Last of Us, which is a great game about two people, an older guy and a younger girl that are traveling in basically the apocalypse or a dystopia. Well, she needs a theme. And he needs a theme. And then they need a theme maybe for a situation. And then the whole game needs an overall theme, just like a movie. And you kind of start with that. You usually get into the mechanics after you've kind of thought thematically about what you're doing.
After you lay the groundwork for the, I guess, overarching themes of the sound.
Yeah. But it's challenging. But it's when I got into it, there weren't many people on the East Coast composing for video games. And I was lucky enough I got asked to do a video game from South Peak Interactive. They were in Cary, North Carolina. They had pretty big budgets. They wanted an orchestral score, which I knew how to do because I went to school at UNC to study music. And then once I got that under my belt, I went out to the West Coast to game conferences and started asking people, where do I get gigs for video game music? And then I met people and I got in at a pretty good time, especially when people were incorporating orchestra into their video game scores. They wanted it to sound like movies, basically.
Right.
So I was pretty lucky with that and ended up, I've done probably over 80 video games. So I've been very, very fortunate and also made some of my best friends in the world through video game people. They're just the greatest. All musicians are great though. they really are.
There's right. Some very open breed of people.
Yeah.
Now you have plenty of new music, including a new album coming out early 2021 that we are absolutely going to get to. But before we do, I did want to ask you a couple questions about the work you did for the video game, The Hobbit. Which may be your most recognizable work in video games.
Probably.
Getting that right.
Yeah.
now, I have many questions about this because I'm not an enormous Lord of the Rings fan. I do love the stories and I love the films, but I'm not like a Tolkien fanatic like I know some people are, including the producer of this show, who is absolutely a Tolkien fanboy, and I don't think he'd be embarrassed by me saying that. So I wanted to ask you, so I believe the video game The Hobbit, which has a huge cult following, I say that as politely as possible.
Well, no, a lot of people as kids played that video game. It's 18 years old. No, it's 16 years old now.
Right. Yeah. I believe, and you would know better than me, but I was looking into it. I think it came out in 2003 or 2002. Yeah. And as soon as I saw the cover, I recognized it. I've never played it, but I didn't have a game console. But I always saw that cover for that game. And I was wondering, kind of to go back to the film thing, I think The Fellowship of the Rings came out in 2001. And that, the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy, the soundtrack for that is iconic. Yeah. And, I think I was looking into it. It was ranked like number one soundtrack of all time, 5 years running, by I think Classic FM or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, what was it like composing for the Hobbit video game when you have Howard Shore, who composed for the Fellowship of the Ring at that time?
Yeah.
You know, were you using any of the stuff that came out from Howard Shore's work on the film to influence what you were doing with the video game?
Wow, I haven't talked about The Hobbit in a long time. I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, good. I was hoping I wasn't bringing up anything that you were sick of about.
No, getting The Hobbit game, we had to audition for that. You have to do demos like anything else. They were doing a composer search. I had met a person, it was the game company in Austin, And he knew I played guitar because a lot of my demos had guitar on it. So I was included in the composer search, and they mentioned Howard Shore, but we didn't have access, and they didn't want to use any of Shore's music. It was a whole different project, but it was under the Tolkien Universal Vivendi umbrella, right?
Not affiliated with the film.
No.
To make sure I'm not pissing off any Tolkien fanatics, I do understand that The Hobbit is a different story than The Lord of the Rings, but yeah, like you said, Tolkien universe.
This was treated as a separate deal for the game. Of course, when we heard about it, we thought, oh, we're going to meet Howard Short, Peter Jackson. No. Peter Jackson had nothing to do with this game.
Right.
But we auditioned for it, and usually when you have a game of this size, they send out what they call guide tracks. They put together music, and it's usually film music, of what they're looking for, the style. Mm-hmm. And Howard Shore was in there. But they also had guitar tracks, acoustic guitar tracks. And I thought, man, this is going to be cool. And they had, do you know who Michael Hedges is? The acoustic guitar player, Michael Hedges. He passed away many years ago. And I was a big Michael Hedges fan. And they had a Michael Hedges track in there. And I went,
oh, nice.
Wow. So I immediately started getting up on my acoustic guitar chops, and Dave Adams, who was a good friend of mine, he also worked at my studio, and we worked on this demo together. So it was Dave Adams and me, and I played all the guitar stuff, and Dave was a keyboard guy, and we worked on this demo for 3 or 4 weeks, and it was Celtic. Basically Celtic with orchestra, but then you've got this Leo Kottke 12 string that comes in. And that's what got us the gig. The guy said, man, the guitar work, it's exactly what I'm looking for. So there you go. If you listen to some of The Hobbit, and that soundtrack is up on Bandcamp. It's free.
Okay. Now, I did listen to it, but I listened to it through YouTube, and I'm glad I did. Hopefully it's not a, infringement or anything, but I'm glad I did because it allowed me to read through some of the comments. Now, I don't know if you've done this or not, but that was the best way for me to understand what this soundtrack means to people.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware on how much, let me just say I'm sure are very familiar with the critical acclaim. The critical acclaim for the work you did on this video game is phenomenal. You won a BAFTA for it, I believe.
Actually, no, that was another video game.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
But we did win like video game soundtrack of the year.
Yes.
At the International Game Developers Conference that year.
Right. So, the critical acclaim is very easy to find. Now, when when I was going through when I listened to it through YouTube, I read some of the comments too, and I wrote some of them down to share with you because I wasn't sure.
Oh man, I have not looked.
Okay, good.
No,
Here, let me just read a couple of these for you because this is the best way to show how impactful that soundtrack is outside of the critical acclaim. So first we've got, who is the composer of this game? I think he is the greatest musician of all time. Then we've got Skyrim wishes it had a soundtrack this epic.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I know Skyrim is known for, I know
Skyrim
about video games.
Skyrim is top shelf.
Yeah. Right. So it doesn't even hold a candle to you, Rod. Then we've got, hopefully you didn't compose. I should have looked. You didn't compose that one as well, did you?
What? Which one?
Skyrim?
No, I didn't. That was another composer.
Good. Dodged a bullet there. Then here's one. I like this one a lot. This remains one of my favorite adventure games. Great music. By the way, the credit for this music goes to Rod Abernathy and Dave Adams. Abernathy is especially genius.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So somebody took the time not only to write this, but like give you and Dave Adams credit, which is pretty cool. Everybody complains about the comment section on YouTube, and in some cases, rightfully so. But these are the best, you know, the best of what it can be. And I've got one more that that was my favorite. Words cannot express the orgasmic amount of nostalgia I'm feeling right now. Listening to that soundtrack.
Oh my. Oh, I, that is so funny. Well, it's very touching because it was a lot of love went into that soundtrack and making that stuff. And a funny side story on this, one of the other composers that was competing to get the game, and he's really good, and I won't mention him by name, but he's really, really good, and he's also one of my best friends in video games. He didn't get it. We got the gig, and he, like a month later, became the Tolkien music director for all Tolkien music games. So he ended up being our, not boss, but he was our higher up and approved everything. So the guy you're competing with ended up being the guy you're working for.
Right.
And we became really good friends. And one of the funniest things was I did a track and I put a marimba in one of the tracks. A marimba is like a wooden xylophone. It's like, dum, 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 that kind of sound. And he came back one time. He said, love the track, but there are no marimbas in Hobbiton. And you kind of have to think about that. I guess not. It's full of, you know, guitars and flutes and cellos and strings, but
no marimbas in the Shire.
No marimbas in the Shire. Anyway, thank you for bringing all that up. That's very, that touches me.
Oh, really. Well, I'm glad. Well, I figured, you know, if you hadn't read through there, that, I mean,
I haven't.
That's just, you know, three or four out of, I mean, we're talking hundreds, maybe thousands of comments from people that actively go on YouTube and listen to the, you know, listen to the soundtrack. There were also people like, oh, here, you can download it here, or you can listen to it on Bandcamp. And, you know, it was the most gracious comment section I've ever seen on YouTube.
Wow, man. You made my day.
Oh, well, good. Yeah. Hey, you know, listening to the soundtrack, it made my day as well. I've been listening to it while I go running.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, of course. So as you were saying, the acoustic guitar was one of the things that put you over the top for that soundtrack. And yeah, it certainly comes through. And it's a big part of your new album, Normal Isn't Normal Anymore. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, your introduction to acoustic guitar, because in the album, you have a song on there called Quiet Man, which I related to very much and enjoyed immensely. And I had read that your father was actually the one who encouraged you and introduced you to acoustic guitar. Do I have that right?
That's not really, but he did. My big brother had an acoustic guitar, and that's where I kind of hijacked his guitar. And I was playing electric guitar and acoustic guitar at the same time. But my dad bought me my first electric guitar. And that's a verse that's in the song.
Right.
About us going to the music store, and I wasn't really sure what was going on. And he didn't really say, let's get in the car and I'm going to go buy you a new guitar. He just kind of went, let's take a trip, you know, down to Spartanburg and, you know, go to a music store and just see. And, you know, that... But my dad was very instrumental, no pun intended, in me playing guitar, and mom, because they always supported it, even though I know they were extremely worried when I came home from college and said, I'm going to do music for a living. I could just see them kind of go, uh-oh.
Sure.
So, but yeah, my dad was a big influence on my music.
Yeah. You know, you have a couple of songs on the album that are completely instrumental, which I enjoyed. You have one on there called Over the Fence.
Yeah.
So now in your, you know, in some of the press briefings and stuff that I got, you know, it gives a little bit of descriptions. And I think I read a little bit in American Songwriter, where they released one of your singles, where they, you know, I get a little bit of insight into the song. And so this completely instrumental song, Over the Fence, I believe is about a dog that you used to have, which.
Yeah. It's, she's still with us.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And her name is Maddie. She's a rescue. She's a treeing walker coonhound, which means that she wants to run all the time.
Sure.
And she's probably looking for her pack, whatever. Yeah. But if the door was open, she's gone. And she's tagged, and she's also has the phone, her phone number on her collar. But she could jump a fence, you know, she could get over a 6-foot fence easy. And that's what the song's about. I came up with this kind of riff or chord progression, and I was thinking, well, and then I think Maddie had escaped that day. She's escaped maybe 40 times. I'm not kidding.
No,
we always get a call from somebody. We actually got a call from a woman who, the third time she caught Maddie, the woman was really mad at me. She said, can't you keep your dog in your house? And blah, blah, blah. And I went, you've never had a hound dog, have you? But I called it Over the Fence because I was watching her go over the fence. And I went, okay, there's a soundtrack to her running away.
Right.
That's what it's about.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had a dog just like this. It was a black lab named Bandit, which...
That good name.
The name could not have been any better. And so when you say your dog escaped 40 times, I 100% believe you. Where I grew up was, we were in the suburbs, and we had like a 3-rail fence, and this dog could just clear it. He was very tall for a lab. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he would just get a running start and just hop over these fences. And like you, we would be getting calls. I was a nervous wreck all the time because I was terrified of him escaping, but there was nothing we could do to keep him in. And he always came back. He was like the most loyal dog ever, but he just had that wanderlust.
Yeah.
And we would constantly get calls. And I mean, this dog, you know, was incredibly lucky because we had a Route 20 not far from our house, you know, and it was like, four lanes of traffic at least going fast. And he would cross it all the time and go into the shopping center.
Oh, man.
So he'd be walking through the supermarket, you know, called Giant Eagle. He would just walk through. They'd get him at Chili's all the time, and the police would call, and we got Bandit again.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just.
That is funny. Same thing with us. She went all the way downtown. It's about 2 miles in the middle of Raleigh. I got a call from a police officer.
Yep.
And he said, we got your dog. Called Mandy, Maddie, is this your dog? And then when I got down there, the officer said, if you ever want to, let Maddie go, call me or call the police.
Right.
And I went down there and Maddie was holding court. She had 4 people and 2 policemen waiting on me. And she was just sitting there going, ha, 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 ha. Yeah. Like, okay, let's go. She's very lucky. Like you said, they are lucky because but they do get hit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But that song's about Maddie. And, you know, I'm getting ready to release another album, but it's a real small run of just guitar instrumentals.
Oh, just instrumental?
Yeah. So, that's, I don't know about the distribution on that yet, but people have asked me, why don't you have something you can, you know, sell at shows and whatever. But my last album, The Man I'm Supposed to Be, had a whole CD of guitar instrumentals on it, just like those two that you're hearing.
So when you're doing instrumental work like that, like, you know, like we were just talking about, you kind of have a backstory for songs like Over the Fence. Is that common most of the time where you, I'm trying to imagine coming from the perspective of somebody who also composes music. So is there usually a theme that you want to make a sound to? Or do you usually find the sound first and then kind of attribute a meaning to it or a backstory?
I'm usually finding some kind of sound or something and then probably relating that to a story.
Right.
It's kind of like if I'm trying to write a song and sometimes I'll come up, whatever is moving me so much, I want to write a song about it. And that's kind of what happened with my song Normal. Isn't Normal Anymore, that's on the album. There were a few things that I had seen on the news and I went, I've got to write something about it. But with an instrumental, I usually will come up with a chord progression or a riff that I can't get out of my head and I'm just playing it. And then all of a sudden, oh, maybe that would be Maddie jumping over the fence. Or the tune Whiskey and Pie that's on the new album. Mm-hmm. That's an actual thing that these friends of mine, they put on the table at Folk Alliance. And it's called Folk Alliance Regional Midwest. They have it in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This could take an hour for me to explain. I'm sorry.
Oh, take your time.
I don't know if you know anyone, your listeners, or you know about Folk Alliance International, but it's a large, multi-thousand group of people who love acoustic guitar, folk and Americana, some bluegrass, and they have conferences all over the country. They have a conference in the South, they have a conference in the Midwest, they have a conference in the Northeast, and a conference, you know, in the mid. And you go to these conferences and the hotels, they take a hotel, a conference hotel for maybe 4 days, and it's nothing but music. And the hotel rooms are filled with people playing in hotel rooms almost all night. Sure. It's incredible. So we discovered this about 5 years ago. I started going. And one of the guys, you know, you're in a room, hotel room, people are playing 1 o'clock in the morning, but one room was known to have whiskey and homemade pie.
Seems like all kinds of whiskey.
So I always, you know, about that time, this was at Folk Alliance Regional Midwest, which is called FARM. Yeah.
Right.
I went, let's get over to Phil Slate's room. Come on, let's go. Let's have some whiskey and pie. And when I got home, I was working on an instrumental, which is the one you're hearing. And I just said, I'm going to name that Whiskey and Pie. So I don't know why. It doesn't really sound like you're eating whiskey and pie, but I just like the name of whiskey.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe it just brings you back to the, you know, the feeling. That was in Phil Slate's room.
Phil Slate's room. Well, I actually got to play that in the room last year, that song for them, for the Whiskey and Pie. So that meant a lot.
Yeah.
You know, to but I love the guitar instrumentals. It's really a big part of my show when I play live. It's been hard to sort of incorporate it into an album with songs. What are your thoughts? Did you think it worked okay to have those instrumentals?
Oh, well, first off, my opinion should have no bearing, but I personally love instrumentals in albums, and I really love you know, so the first time I had heard these kind of transitional songs, not that your instrumental songs are, but was maybe with like Pink Floyd, where you would go from one song to another and you wouldn't really realize that there was a song sandwiched in between that could stand alone. That those are things that I love in albums. I love instrumentals. And actually, we just had a bluegrass band called Wooden Wire on the show recently. And we were kind of having the same discussion where they finished the album with this all instrumental song, you know, and he was saying how nervous he was to put it on, that it was a big, maybe nervous isn't the right way to put it, but there was a big discussion on whether it would be appropriate or not to finish the album with all instrumentals. I absolutely think it works. And I think the people that really are your fans like to hear stuff like that. And I think people do really like things that kind of buck the trend, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a good palate cleanse as well.
Well, thanks. That's a good way to look at it too, a palate cleanse.
Well, especially, you know, for someone like you, Rod, where you're very open lyrically. So, you know, your lyrics give people plenty to think about. You know, when you have a song that is lyric focused, that is clearly taking center stage. What you're saying through your songs is kind of the main priority, and it's very clear. It's not ambiguous. It's this is the message of the song.
Yeah.
This is kind of what is intended to be thought about. And you know, just like for people who read, you know, it's hard to go from one really heady book to another. You know, you kind of need a little bit of time to digest. And so if you've got an album, you know, just like Normal Isn't Normal Anymore, where you're discussing things like you did in Quiet Man, and then you have some instrumentals thrown in there as well, it kind of gives you time to digest and really process some of the lyrical side of your music as well.
Yeah. That's I've never heard it put quite so eloquently.
Well, I appreciate that
word. Eloquently. Well, no, it's that makes sense to me. And I guess when I'm playing live, that really is what I'm thinking too. It's kind of, okay, let's take a break. Let's have a little fun and take a break on guitar.
Right. Yeah. It's very common at shows, you know, where there are long solos and things like that. And that goes without saying, but then you don't really see it on albums as much anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And it's an intensity. It's a different kind of intensity. And people don't really know it's an instrumental coming up either. I mean, sometimes I know Over the Fence might be another song and they're going, oh, he's not singing. What's going on?
Right.
Go, oh, it's an instrumental. Okay. Well, do you play?
I don't. Rod, I have literally no musical talent whatsoever. So I know it's a little, the irony of me hosting this podcast is not lost.
yeah, but your love for music is so upfront and center. It's really, you know, it's great. It's music.
That. Well, thanks. Talking with someone like you is great because, and that's primarily why we kind of focus on the singer-songwriter, because I feel like at the very least, I can communicate about themes and things of that nature. And I'm curious enough to where when we talk about instrumentals, I know nothing. So it kind of allows the guest to really go over it with a fine tooth comb and express it in a way, a way that everyone can digest. I don't know if you've ever seen The Office, but
I watch it still watch it all the time.
Oh, okay, me too. There's a scene, and this is exactly how I think about the podcast. There's a scene where Steve Carell, who plays the office manager, I think everyone knows that, but he's having something explained to him. I think about like quarterly numbers, and he tells the person who's explaining it, okay, explain it to me like I'm a 10-year-old. And then they break it down and they explain it very simply, and he still doesn't get it. And he's like, okay, explain it to me like I'm six. that's exactly how I approach this podcast, Rod. I don't know anything. And so I think people who have a much, you know, listeners of this podcast who have a much better grasp on music as a pursuit, it allows them to, you know, to get it crystal clear, I think, you know.
Yeah, well, having it as a pursuit too can also take away the joy of listening to it sometimes.
That is interesting.
You're trying to analyze and you have to stop analyzing. I mean, I've listened to stuff. It's just hard for me to listen to things, even background music in a store will piss me off.
Sure.
And yeah, I've just been, my wife's going, what are you doing? And I'm like, I hate this thing that's coming out of the ceiling. Where can I stop it? And nobody else even, you know, cares. It's background music, it's elevator music. But then other times I'm doing the opposite, where I'm at the grocery store and I haven't heard a song in 10 years and it's piping through and she's going, what are you doing? I'm listening to this song. And I'm just in the middle of the aisle, just like, you know, like I'm lost. I'm just like, wow. And you know, it's crazy. But my tastes vary too. I mean, I'm listening to James Brown 1 minute, and then I'm listening to Chopin or Shostakovich in the next, and then Leo Kottke. I mean, it's pretty schizo, you know, what I listen to.
Well, I think that's what probably helps round out your, you know, the composition that you do, because it is very diverse just from the little that I've heard.
Well, it's been diverse to the point where I've had a kind of a hard time branding my sound. I mean, even with just composing, I know a lot of composers that are well known for one style, and that's what they get hired for. And I've never really been, I mean, The Hobbit is great because it is a style that I really love, acoustic, Celtic, action orchestral. But when I got back into playing live, it was the focus that I wanted, like acoustic guitar, vocal. I'm not really crazy about the term singer-songwriter, but there isn't really a replacement for that.
Right. I mean, you'd
say singer-songwriter-performer. But it made me focus again on singing and playing acoustic guitar like I was doing when I first got out of college. And it's been incredible for me.
Well, I don't think you're the only one who contends with this. So this is actually a real point of interest for me, where, you know, kind of like personality traits. So obviously, like we said earlier, musicians are a breed of, you know, very open people, but there are degrees to openness. So like you said, your interest, using your words, are, you know, can be schizo, where it's like, they're all over the place. Right. Yeah. So being a very lateral thinker, I'm similar, where you and I probably have high marks in openness, and where that's really good for creativity, the main drawback, from what I understand, is it can be really hard to nail down an identity or not just, you know, I don't know about you, but maybe not even just from a musical perspective. Like for me in general, it's like I have so many interests spread across so many different things, from thinking laterally instead of specializing, that like sometimes I'm like, whoa, what am I even doing? You know, how did I end up hosting this podcast? You know, so
yeah.
So it's a common thing, I think, a common push and pull for people that are very open and interested in so many different things or different styles of music.
If you're trying to make a living, it can be difficult.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything creative, and then you add, you know, multi-passionate to that, and it's an uphill battle.
Yeah. But the fact that you have the podcast, that's your format. That's your forum. You can have different styles and different people on it. If your listeners know you're not just one music style podcast. I think people like that. I think that works for you.
But
it's not that you're not going way off the chart with trying to be different.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely not. So I wonder, just to kind of get back into, I mentioned it briefly earlier with Quiet Man. You know, it seems like your relationship with your dad, you know, he was a very caring, but quiet man. And you had kind of brought up towards the end of the song that, you know, you feel similarly, where it's like, you know, I want to, you know, express, or I feel a great degree of care for people, but maybe I don't know, you know, always express it. You know, I think you were mentioning your son in that song.
Yeah.
But at the same time, your music and your lyrics are very expressive. Do you find that maybe this is just the one outlet where it can really come through?
Music and my art, which is not really something I'm speaking to my son, but I am definitely catharting with my art and my photography. But that's also a kind of an introverted expression, if that makes any sense. You're by yourself when you create it.
Right.
Being able to express with song in the past, I'd say 4 or 5 years, has really changed my whole outlook on relationships. I know that's pretty heavy, but when you're a composer, you're working these days, you're usually working in a small room in front of TV monitors by yourself all day long with maybe phone calls or emails to your client. All day long, week after week. And then you might have other friends, but you're not, your music is an expression, but I wouldn't say it's communicating like a song communicates. So this goes back to about 6 years ago when I said, I'm going to start writing songs again and singing. I want to sing, because there's something about singing that's like nothing else. It's therapeutic, but it's also, it's like you talking on your podcast. I mean, it's, you're voicing your opinion. It's coming from the source out your mouth, and hopefully people will listen to it and accept it in a good way. And that's changed me a lot. My father wasn't that kind of guy. I mean, he would talk, but when he said something, he didn't do random talking, you know.
Right.
When he said something, that's what he meant. And it wasn't in a mean way. It was just like, yeah, the sky's blue.
Right.
Yeah, that rain is wet. I mean, and I'm putting it very simply, but he wouldn't go on about, man, I saw a great show last night. Let me tell you what I think about it. And let me tell you what my political thoughts are about this and that. And he wouldn't do that. I actually had that dream. He's been gone now for about 6-7 years. I had the dream where I picked up a phone in the kitchen, one of those wall phones that had the coily cord, and there was my dad talking, and he was talking not like he was 90, because he was like 92 when he passed. He was talking like a young guy, like he was 35, and he was actually talking. He was like, "Hey, how's it going? How's your day been? Hey, what are you up to? How's Matthew and Suzanne? Tell me what's going on." And I'm like, "Is this really Dad?"
Right.
But it was his voice, and it lasted with me all day long. And then came the song. So, you know, last Christmas Eve, and it was around Christmas time, this Christmas Eve, I had a dream my father was reaching out to me. And he did. He somehow reached out to me in a younger voice. So by the end of the song, it kind of made me realize that, yes, I can be like that with my son, and I need to talk to my son more. I need to let him know who I am, not just that I'm here. And yeah, the sky's blue. Yeah, and it's raining today. Let him know more about who I am. And is this making any sense at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I tend to ramble.
No, not at all. Podcasts are the perfect medium for it.
Yeah. I had struggled with that song for so long, like for months. I couldn't come up with the last verse. And I was talking to my wife, Suzanne, about it. And she was helping me kind of get in the mind frame of it. And then that last verse hit me about how, yeah, look at my son. He's 21 and a father someday he will become. And I hope someday he'll understand that sometimes I can be a quiet man. That just came out. I went, okay. And there you go. I mean, I felt like everybody who's a father has the potential of being that quiet man, you know?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. You know, as a matter of fact, I come from a long line of, you know, men who suffer from Irish stoicism, you know, not very expressive people. And I can tend to be that way myself. In fact, your song, I was listening to Quiet Man, and it gave me kind of the same thought that you had, where it was like, you know, you had that dream about your dad and you're like, maybe I need to, you know, speak to my son more. I'm not a father, but, you know, I'm in a relationship, and just a personal anecdote. So the past 2 days, my fiance has had this horrible migraine. And it's not common for her to have migraines. I have migraines often.
Yeah.
And it really was bothering her, as it does. And you know, sometimes I think in an attempt to be calm, or like the calmest guy in the room, or whatever, you know, not to be shaken by what's going on around me, sometimes I think I can come off as like very callous and uninterested. And it's not that, you know, I was very concerned that she was experiencing this migraine, but I also didn't want to, I play my cards kind of close to the chest, so I didn't want to, you know, seem frantic or whatever. And it made me feel, you know, listening to your song made me think like, ah, shit, you know, maybe I should let her know, like, I'm not uninterested or unconcerned with this migraine that's been going on. I really am worried about it. And I'm glad the migraine has passed, and I'm glad we made a doctor's appointment and all that thing. Yeah. Where maybe in the moment I wasn't. I actually, after listening to your song, sent her, you know, a text saying like, hey, all of those things that I'm telling you now, because I think for men especially, and men who come from kind of a, you know, fathers who play their, like I said, kind of play their cards close to their chest.
Yeah.
It can have its pros and cons, you know, and I think it could be tough for guys to, you know, express how they're feeling, especially in the moment.
Yeah. And it's not just father. Like you said, I mean, it can be, it's a simple thing of, you know, just talk more, I guess. Or be more empathetic, but you are being empathetic. I haven't really given it that much thought actually, because I express so much in the song to explain the song. I've never really done that.
Well, that's interesting, Rod, because I've been reading into some mythology and some theory on mythology, and they were talking about how oftentimes you see it in children and you see it in old myths and current myths and all that kind of thing, where we act things out before we can fully articulate them ourselves. And I was just about to say, you cover kind of this push-pull that I was mentioning of being kind of strong and silent, and also, you know, knowing when to be that and knowing when to be more expressive. And I think in the song that you talk about, and forgive me, I don't want to bring up
something
that you don't want to talk about, but you know, you had death in your family, and that your father was a very strong, a pillar of strength during that time. And sometimes being that kind of unshaken, quiet guy is a really good thing. And sometimes you need to swing the pendulum the other way. And, you know,
yeah, you do. That was a hard day. I won't go into it, but when my brother passed away, dad was, he was a rock.
Right.
And, you know, pretty much say it in the song. And everybody has to go through that stuff. I mean, we all have to, you know, have to face that kind of family tragedy, but, you know, along with family joys, it just comes along, you know, it's part of the deal. But I think moms and dads, how they teach their children, there's no manual on how to do any of this. I mean, you can say, yeah, I've read this book, or I saw this or that, but each family, they don't come with manuals of how to do it. And I really think parents, especially these days, you're having to make a lot of stuff up. I mean, it's our children are grown up now, and I'm feel lucky that they are, but I just feel so much for parents who are having to homeschool and be so much more than what they expected, probably.
Right. I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, and in some ways, it makes a tighter family unit. In other ways, parents just really have to be on it. And you just gotta, instead, you know, and then we're in the age of social media, which is a curse and a blessing. So I don't know how I would handle it these days if I had teenagers.
Well, no, like you said, just like there's no manual to parenting at large, we don't know how to handle, you know, there's no manual for figuring out. The current technology that we are all touched by in some way.
Yeah. And your kids are watching you. They're watching what you do. You know, you have to, good and bad. I mean, you know, you have to be aware of whatever you're doing. Your kids they're watching you. And you're setting the example. And I wasn't a great example in many ways. I mean, I tried, you know, but you just do the best you can do, and whatever. I'm way off into some other tangent now.
That's what this podcast is about. No, that's.
I'm glad
great.
You brought up the song, because the song still makes me cry when I sing it.
Oh, I can imagine. It's a very, like I said, you know, it compelled me to, you know, to take inventory of my behavior as well.
Yeah, I have to be careful when I sing it in front of people, because if I don't distance myself a little bit, I get caught up in the lyrics and I'll tear up. But then I have people sometimes come up after a show, and this wasn't recently, this is pre-COVID when we were playing. People would come up and just say, that song about your dad, that was my dad. Or I had to leave the room during your show and go call my father. And you know, to have that kind of thing touch someone, I mean, that just means everything to me. That's like, wow, that's why I wanted to sing that song. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, and I think, like you said, seeing it at shows and people that are just listening to it when they come across your album, I think it is a powerful song, and I think it's powerful because it many, many people can relate, and you did an incredible job of making sure it's not a one-dimensional song. Like we said, there's a big push-pull to when to be a quiet man and when to be expressive. And
you know, well, thank you. Thank you for picking that out. I'm shooting a video of it in the next few weeks, which is going to be a little challenging, but I'm interested to see how it comes out.
That's excellent. Yeah, I can't wait to watch it. So, Rod, for people that want to hear your music and check out the new album, where is the best place for them to go?
Well, it's coming out in February, which seems like a long time, but it'll be here. February will be here before you know it.
Yeah. Unless the world ends, barring the world ending.
I know. Let's get through January. But we won't get into that with the podcast.
Sure.
it's going to be released in February, and check my website if you can't find it anywhere else. Of course, it's going to be on, you know, Spotify and SoundCloud.
All the streaming platforms. And what was the name of your website, Rod?
RodAbernathy.com.
Excellent.
And that's N-E-T-H-Y.
Yeah, I'll be sure to put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, if people want to look at my composer website, they type in RodAbernathyComposer.com.
Perfect. And is there anywhere on social media or anything that you'd like people to find you?
Facebook, Rod Abernathy. I do Twitter and Instagram too, but most of it, I have a personal page and an artist page on Facebook.
Perfect. All right.
And thank you so much. This hour went by pretty quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I could definitely do another couple hours with you, and I'd love to in the future. So thank you very much for coming on the show, Rod.
Sure thing, Jake. And you take care.
You too.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Rod for coming on the show. Upon its release, February 5th, check out Rod's new album, Normal Isn't Normal Anymore. In a world gone mad, it's just what the doctor ordered. If you want to keep up with us at Setlist, you can head over to our website, setlist.community. That's where you're going to find all of our previous podcasts, our blog posts, and our merchandise. If you want to follow us on social, it's at Setlist Community on Instagram. Thanks again for tuning in. We will catch you next time. Peace.